Good morning, this is Erin.
Hi, Erin. I have a situation I'd like to talk with you through.
Sure.
I know that districts, we do take our time and take those threats of safety very seriously.
As well we should, yes.
We are following the law regarding holding threats at risk assessments. And when those threats are made or safety concerns, they are an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But the conversations at the threat assessment team table are becoming concerning.
Okay.
There is not a loud voice in the room regarding the rights of students with disabilities, and the team believes they can override the decisions of the IEP team. Are there any ways that you can suggest that can help us with these issues?
Welcome to Season 2 of On the Call, Ennis Britton's Special Education Law Podcast. I'm Erin Wessendorf-Wortman.
And I am Jeremy Neff.
And we are ready to dig into this call. So I don't know about you, Jeremy, but I'm getting more and more phone calls about what these threat assessment teams within our schools look like and how to really balance everything that they touch, because it's not just about making sure students are safe, right? We have a kind of a plethora of laws that we have to consider with it.
Yeah, and this is certainly not something that's unique to Ohio. We'll talk a little bit about some requirements here, but we know from talking to colleagues across the country and going to conferences, there are laws that are being developed across the country. Even the Secret Service has jumped in, right, and given
they
us
did.
A couple of versions of guides to help schools deal with threat assessments.
And so at least we know in Ohio there was a Save Students Act, the Safety and Violence Education Students, which it seemed strange to just throw students on there again, but fine. And so at least in Ohio we have a statutory requirement, which is why we have to mention it, to have these threat assessment teams for every building serving students in 6 to 12. And that means that there's a whole host of people on the teams. But I think with that host of people, you're bringing in, right, SROs, mental health professionals, school admin folk. We have a lot of cooks in that kitchen, all bringing their own training and their own methodologies, but also maybe not having the background that school folk have.
Yeah, this often can be a source of challenge in special education, right, where within our own office, if a call comes in for special education, there are a handful of attorneys that are the ones that take those calls. There are other attorneys that throw the phone across the room. In the school world, sometimes there's also a little bit of a distinction about the ability of somebody to respond to a concern. But the law here requires that we bring in these folks.
Well, and it requires us to also make sure they're all trained. And I think that understanding where these people are trained and what information to give them so that they don't in turn help the district violate the law, right? It, even unwittingly, right? No one that I am aware of in schools is purposely going out. And I think I've said this over a multiple of podcasts. Mm-hmm. No one's going out trying to break the law. But we can have some inadvertent issues, right? FERPA is always one that I love talking about because I'm a FERPA nerd, and I think it's interesting. But there are, you know, certain exceptions to FERPA that allow people to disclose information. So very broadly speaking, FERPA, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, is a federal law prohibiting the disclosure of personally identifiable information of students from their education records, right, without parent consent. But they do have two exceptions. Well, a multitude of exceptions, but of the two for threat assessments, right? You're talking about school officials with a legitimate educational interest, and schools can determine who is a school official, which is kind of fun, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like in my house, I determine I'm the winner in most board games because I have to clean it up. So
there's that.
There's also this health and safety exception, which I know oftentimes in conversations with SROs or police departments, they'll want to say, well, I mean, I'm an SRO. I have this automatic exception. But what we have to remember is the exception only exists for the time period of that emergency, right? So for that health and safety emergency, that therein lies that exception.
And that when you say for the duration of that emergency, meaning the emergency is presently carrying out, not that it's being investigated.
Correct.
Or something like that after the fact.
Correct.
Well, another area that we can run into trouble with this is child fines, then, whether we're talking about under IDEA or Section 504, because if this threat or, you know, perceived threat is coming from a student who's not yet identified, it could be that implementing whatever threat assessment process your district has could start to tread into the territory of child find. And have we learned something here? Do we have knowledge? Are people reporting concerns to others, or parents maybe even, if they're a part of this, reporting concerns that should trigger child find processes?
Well, and also then let's assume, so we have the child find aspect of it, and then on the other end of that spectrum, let's assume someone's already identified. We might have a threat assessment team who just looks at the situation and says, well, get the kid out. Just remove the concern during the time period of the emergency, right? So that we can appropriately do an investigation, do a review. And while it all sounds well and good, it could be a situation where we've just changed placement of a student for potentially disciplinary reasons, right? And even if not potentially disciplinary, we could have just removed a kid from their placement for X number of days while an investigation is being played out.
And you know, I think this is what you're saying, but that applies even to kids who are not yet identified. We can have knowledge that would be imputed upon the district through this whole process. So a lot of tricky things to deal with here. And stepping back then just very broadly to the concept of just discrimination under Section 504, for example, we know that there are some exceptions that allow us to appropriately respond to safety threats. And we know those are being taken pretty seriously. And in the courts, we get some decisions where sometimes even we're surprised, like, wow, the court let the school do that. Pretty cool in terms of responding to a safety concern. So we know that an individual who poses a direct threat to the health or safety of others, we get a little bit of flexibility under
Correct.
Section 504 in responding to that. But those are very high dollar words there, direct threat to the health or safety of others.
Well, and it really means a very fact-intensive review of what's going on. We're not talking about a simple, oh, well, you made a threatening statement, and so onward and upward we go. We have a school looking at individualized assessments that are pulling in medical knowledge, medical expertise, right? What are we looking at from reports? Looking at what really is the threat. Was there a duration of the threat? What was really the severity of the risk? And looking at the probability of whether injury could occur. We're digging into the meat and potatoes of the situation, not just looking at it and going, oh, you made a threat and you're out. And I think, you know, from a special education perspective, and I know we've talked and I'm dabbling in a couple of different worlds here, and I know that, but from those in the special education world, we have those exceptions, right, in the MDR process or for an interim alternative educational setting, or we're like, whoa, 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 people see that as a threat, right? We have the exceptions for drugs, weapons, serious bodily injury, but all of those are action items, right? And then you also have the, if you maintain a placement, it's substantially likely to cause injury to that student or others. That tends to mean there's action involved as well. And so I don't want sometimes well-intentioned maybe administrators who are like, I know my special ed, right? Isn't there this exception out there that exists for this substantial likelihood of injury? Yes, but I question at times, right, and it's all fact-specific, whether a threat really is that substantial likelihood of injury to self or others.
Yeah, you'd want to know, some of the things that would go into a threat assessment, like how specific is a student describing something? What access do they have to do the things? If a student says, I'm going to drop a nuclear bomb on this building, I'm not too concerned. If a student says, I'm going to poison you with this readily available material that's here in the school, maybe it's a little bit different.
It could
How's
be.
How's that for a segue?
That was a really good segue into the case. But I think with all of it, and in going into that case, we look at these threat assessments the same for every kid. So we can't just jump ship and go up. We can do a 45-day IAES here. We can't do that. You have to walk them through that same process you would for any other kid. It's just that the determination on the other side of that threat assessment or what happens in the room during the threat assessment must include a consideration and not just lip service of the student's disability. Yeah. Right? So thank you for my lovely, you know, my lovely softball that you just threw me. We're looking at a case. Now, granted, it's a 2015 case. So it's out of the Office for Civil Rights, came out of Virginia. So Prince William County. And I realize it's a little old, But honestly, I think so much has happened on building in threat assessment teams into schools across the country over the last few years. And we had COVID over the last few years. I'm really going to be done mentioning that soon. I want to be. But you have to consider kids weren't in schools. So the threats were not as numerous maybe as they had been in years past. And so with this case, at least a little bit of background, we had a twice exceptional student who was in the eligibility category of autism. So was on an IEP about 9 months to a year later, was placed on a BIP due to some behaviors in fourth grade. I mean, it looks pretty typical, right? You have goals every week, about an hour on social skills, another hour on work habits, organizational skills. You have about an hour a month on speech skills. Most gen ed setting, I think, except for 30 minutes a week of some pullout for organizational skills, and the speech was pullout. I mean, not that unremarkable.
No, and I mean, it's a movie we've seen before, right? When you combine social deficits with high intelligence, those kids can do some pretty interesting things.
Absolutely, they can. And so about 9 months after the BIP is in place, the team meets again. We have some behaviors, right? I mean, not – we're talking about kids too, so always unpredictable. But the team met and did what they were supposed to do. Hey, we have an increase in behaviors. Let's meet. They revise the BIP, put some new things in place. But about a month after this, so I believe this was in about December, about January, all of a sudden, this student – says to another kiddo, you know, I'm going to poison this proverbial student C. So, and I'm going to poison them with hand sanitizer. And so at that point, the teacher makes a report to the administration and a threat assessment team is now put into place over this hand sanitizer poisoning threat. Now, again, this is all pre-COVID, right? So still hand sanitizers, very just
readily
right
available.
Yes.
You know, it's not in those early days when it was precious.
I still remember trying to shop for that and the shelves were empty. But I think what happened is the threat assessment was started. Then all of a sudden it was elevated because the district viewed this threat to be moderate risk. And so with that, the next day, the student wasn't allowed to return to school until the IEP team met to determine services and placements. 7 days later, the student was placed on homebound instruction awaiting an autism out-of-district placement.
And the parents just happily went along with that,
no,
right?
No. The day after the sanitizer threat, the poisoning threat, there had to have been more going on. I mean, it's clear because the poisoning threat happened the very next day OCR receives a complaint. And so it's not even that all of the things that happened at the threat assessment team that bounced around really could be considered. There was a lot more going on. But the threat assessment team and the whole situation with that was reviewed. What was shocking, at least from my perspective, right? So let's talk. The threat was made in January. Kid is on homebound instruction for the remainder of the school year, right? And so autism placement isn't open. He's there for the rest of the school year. OCR gets involved. District does what most districts do, because who loves the feds after them? No one, right? And not because they're scary, but because we're school people. We don't like to be called to the principal's office. I get mm-hmm. it. And so they entered into voluntary resolution and they agreed to do all of these things. But with that agreement came some OCR decisions, right?
Yeah. Well, and stepping back, you know, when you said there had to have been more going on, this just has a lot of red flags of that. And it almost feels like instead of the threat assessment process being what it should be, which is keeping kids safe, and we have found that at least courts, maybe not OCR, but courts are relatively forgiving for schools and are erring on the side of caution in light of terrible tragedies that have happened. Here it almost feels like it was this gotcha of, finally, we've got something to trigger the threat assessment process. And this hand sanitizer threat, boy, that's no ordinary threat. That's going to escalate things. We better get rid of the kid for the rest of the semester. We don't know this. Like, we don't have all those facts. But it's a cautionary tale if you start to sense that sort of thing going on in your district of, you know, pump the brakes a little bit if people are headed down that road.
Well, absolutely, right? And it's not that the threat assessment team can make decisions over and beyond the IEP team. right? And I think this is what OCR said with this in forcing the district through the voluntary resolution process. I realize that's a bit of an oxymoron there. But, you know, it is, hey, sign this agreement or we'll investigate more. A lot of people,
yeah, it'd be a shame what would happen to your district if you don't sign this agreement.
It happens. Yeah. Love OCR. You know, if any of them happen to be listening, let's go ahead and say we're not trashing your process, but also, you know, it just is what it is.
Most cases end this way.
Right. And that's okay. But mm-hmm. what OCR said is, listen, district, you failed to really consider the student's disability. You didn't do the individualized process. You pushed it up the chain of going through threat assessment, whatever was the background for doing so. You push it up the train and the kid was not in school. And this was a problem. What you should have done was consider the threat, poisoning by hand sanitizer, and say, what mitigating measures can we do, district, to stop that from going into place? Can there be extra services in the IEP? Can there be a new goal? Do there need to be social stories? There need to be all of these other things. And so the district was encouraged through, you know, voluntary resolution to update policies and procedures and to make sure that for this kid, things were put into place for him on his IEP. He came back that following August back into the school with, you know, an updated IEP for services and sports.
And it's not as though OCR said, well, it's okay to leave him out the rest of the semester. This process would have taken months to unfold. So, like, don't say, ah, they kind of tacitly approved that removal. No, they just didn't get through it. And I think this is a case where it was a short walk from, hey, what this kid did to what his disability is. It was pretty easy for OCR to push things in this direction. I think maybe it would have been different if this was a kid with a hearing impairment, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's a much longer walk from disability to what the kid did. But here, it was, there's just a lot of red flags.
Well, and did you notice there was not a single mention of an MDR happening during this process? So it's not, this is a change in placement. It's clear the parents didn't agree. Now, granted, we're not in Ohio for this case. I get it. But we're not talking about an MDR whatsoever. We're just talking about removal. And I do think, right, those are beyond red flags. Like those are giant potholes that we just have stepped into.
And does that maybe lead us into some practical tips then? Because I think a big part of what's needed is that training. And the training isn't just making sure people know the threat assessment process, but also the people in the threat assessment process understand what special education laws are going to require of them, including that, hey, we've got this other process. We can have twin tracks going here, but we've got this other process we also need to follow.
No, I think all of these individuals need to go through the proper training. I know in Ohio, they have a training requirement to be on the team. And then every few years, I think it's three after that. But no matter where you are, I would hope there's a statutory training requirement. And if there's not, I surely hope your district is smart enough to put one in place. That includes, hey, what about child find? What about evaluation? What are these trigger pieces? What about services for kids who are already identified? Let's dig into those, you know, as I said earlier, the meat and potatoes of these things so that it is training and to make sure our policies are up to date and to require us to do the same thing so that if we have a new person or a parent who's confused about the process, they can be provided those policies, procedures, so they understand from their perspective what's being done by the district.
And the training really making sure that it is multifaceted, right? Because if the training is just on, for example, the Secret Service, I mentioned this before, and just in case you're looking into this for your district, their 2018 version of their guidance for schools is called Enhancing School Safety Using a Threat Assessment Model. So that's a 2018 update on a 2004 document. So they've been working on this for a while. And there's good information in there, but they don't always do a good job then bringing in these other laws. So if we were required to do a training, but the requirement is specifically to the threat assessment, let's go ahead and use that mandated opportunity to bring in the special ed pieces to it. So it's all in one comprehensive approach.
And FERPA. I love me some FERPA. Sorry. But I do think with that, having a good understanding, right, in the training of the non-discrimination and the FAPE rights, but also the trigger words to have in the conversation, right? I mean, I've been at even family functions, not anywhere near work setting, and people be like, oh, that kid's got something wrong with him.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that that's not the best. Now, granted, it's maybe it's my kid they're saying that. But in that, it starts to raise the level of, do we have knowledge? Do we have suspicion of a disability? And so making sure our staff are clear on what those conversations are, as well as then even considering as a team member, do you have the director of student services or special education who understands those interventions or those mitigating pieces that the district can provide to help these behaviors from happening again? Right. And so I think if I find myself in a position that's similar to this caller, right, when we're looking at this broad summary of the full conversation we've had today, you know, if I go from that as your three takeaways, right, we have those pieces of, you know, policies and procedures. I mean, how boring, right? But you get that from the attorneys. But I think I'll capture within the two and three of that is the training. And I think it's training on both the knowledge that you can share, right? So FERPA, how much information you can have. But most importantly, looking at everything with an IDEA lens, a 504 lens, to ensure we're not discriminating against students because of their disability.
Thank you for joining us. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share and give us a review on your favorite podcast platform. And follow or subscribe to On the Call. This helps other special education leaders find the podcast.
If you have a topic you would like to suggest, a question about today's episode, or anything else you'd like to let us know, please email us at podcast@ennisbritton.com.
A quick note, this podcast is intended to be used for general information only and is not legal advice. If you have a specific question, please consult an attorney. Whether by phone or this podcast, we're looking forward to being on the call with you again soon.